Hi, everyone. Today's episode is a fireside chat I was part of with the CEO of the Pinkubator. That's right, the billion-dollar lady, Cindy Eckert, and Aaron Price, the founder of Propelify. The three of us are going to discuss the power of money and how you can utilize money for the right things. You are also going to learn about Cindy's billion-dollar exit and the reason why they will always laugh at you before they applaud you. Text me to join my community at 949-298-2905. And you can always join my free trainings, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time. Just email me at david@dmeltzer.com. This is Entrepreneurs the Playbook.
All right, I'm really excited for this next session. We've got Cindy Eckert and Dave Meltzer. Cindy sold two companies for over $1 billion, Slate Pharmaceuticals and Sprout Pharmaceuticals. Dave Meltzer, who's been a longtime friend of Propelify, is back again. Really appreciate having you here, Dave. Dave's the CEO of Sports One Marketing, but if you followed either of their social channels, you'll see that they're involved in quite a bit more. Thank you guys both so much for being here today. I really appreciate it.
It's amazing. I'm so happy to be here and happy to have Cindy joining us. What a pleasure.
Thanks, Aaron. Likewise, always happy to be in Dave's company.
I feel the same way. You both have a really strong mission that you've been very thoughtful about crafting. So I want to start there. Cindy, what's the mission that you've identified? It sounded like it started personally, but now I think it sounds like you infuse it into the business.
Yeah. Look, my mission in the simplest term is to make other women really rich. There's a bleep somewhere in there. And
we're adults. You can put it in if you want.
All right. Really fucking rich. That is really the mission that I'm on with the Pinkubator. And, you know, I say it and it gets a certain reaction. And make no mistake, I've never done anything for the money. But if you do it, the money will flow for the impact. And I think when I say that, I really am eliciting a response that reveals so much in how we think that that's taboo still in society. And as I work with and coach female founders, it's very important to me that they're okay with that outcome. Money is a power in this world. You can do a lot of good. And what it has afforded me in my exits is the ability to bet on and invest in the other things that I want to see come to fruition.
We're going to come back to that in a moment. David, what's your mission?
Now, my mission is to empower over 1 billion people to create a collective consciousness simply of happiness. Happiness being the greatest virus ever. It can be shared simply by witnessing it. It is strengthening us mentally, physically, emotionally, and as Cindy referred to, financially. And it also strengthens our immune system. So it actually can protect us against other viruses. So I believe I can help people to empower others, to make a lot of money, learn how to receive, to help a lot of people, because you can't give what you don't have, and have a lot of fun with our lives, that we can create this empowerment, collective consciousness of happiness, and truly, as a single individual, help to impact the entire world to create abundance.
So I think all three of us share a money motivation, but you know, Dave, behind your head, it says money doesn't buy happiness. You know, Cindy's talking about making women, I think it was, very rich. So where do you see the balance? My mom might be watching. Where do you see the balance of how does money play a factor as a tool, but not the goal in this pursuit? Well, David, we'll start with you since you have the sign.
Yeah, sure. Money to me, it does not buy happiness. And I've learned my lessons over the years, but it allows you to shop. And, you know, if you shop for things you don't need to impress people you don't like, it's not going to make you happy. But if you buy the right things with your money, which is a currency, by the way, which means it's an object of energy, which you put into the flow to get what you want. And I believe faith blended is the same way. Faith is a currency that you put into the flow to get what you want. And so is if you use money as a tool to attract what you want, to get what you want, there's no doubt at this vibration that money allows you to get what you want. But most people don't take the time to figure out what the right things are. For me, it was buying community centers, impacting other people, buying scholarships to college instead of Ferraris, Porsches, motorhomes, boats. That stuff didn't make me happy. I learned after paying a lot of dummy tax, using my money to buy the right things makes you happy.
Yeah, I have a feeling Cindy didn't pay as much dummy tax. Cindy, what do you think the balance is? I mean, I know it's an important mission, empowering anyone, especially women, but what do you think the balance is here?
So look, for me, it is exactly as David said, it's a conduit to do good in this world. And when I look at the landscape, that if you look at the stats, less than 2% of all venture money goes to female founders. We think that half the population has 2% of the good ideas. That's ridiculous. And having gotten to this outcome, for me, it's a wonderful opportunity for me to put my money where my mouth is and bet on other women being overlooked by the system to disrupt. And that disruption not only makes the world a better place through their innovations, but the multiplier effect of ownership, that they then are rewarded by the market, they make money, they bet on the next and the next. And that's really what we're trying to do in the Pinkubator, is this multiplier effect of ownership, an entire pink army, if you will, out there in the world. And I have to apologize to your mother. Sorry, my mom would be so mad
at you. That's all right. That's all right. We want to be real here. Let's tell people about the Pinkubator. And for those who are interested, we have a lot of entrepreneurial viewers. How can they potentially apply?
I love it. So I invest in female disruptors, and particularly in the health and wellness space. And so I'm looking for people with, I love the first to market, the real game changers. And frankly, I love things that are catalysts and social conversations we need to be having. What does that mean? I'll give you a couple examples. So one of my portfolio companies is coming out with the first ever flushable pregnancy test in the world. I think only a woman would have imagined that. The discretion, a lot of women test at work, the eco piece, 80% of your pregnancy test doesn't have to be plastic anymore. And so why would we have that? I have a technology that if I were to dip my finger in a drink and touch a disc, in 30 seconds, it would tell me if there was a date rape drug in that drink. I have two nieces in college. I can't get that to market quickly enough. Those are the kind of things that I'm looking for, really, in the health and wellness space. I love people truly challenging the status quo.
So, David, what do you, for people challenging the status quo, how do they get attention? How do they break out? What do you think makes them successful in potentially capturing the attention of Cindy? We're gonna ask Cindy, of course, momentarily, but capturing your attention and those writing checks to help them get going.
It's so amazing. So I think entrepreneurs do change the world, and they will save the world as well. And Cindy's exactly what I look for in entrepreneurs. People that, like Gary Vaynerchuk, our friend, is known for, that don't give an F about what other people think. I have a saying that they're going to laugh at you, make fun of you, scoff at you, but eventually they will applaud you. And I think that's the story that Cindy carried, and so many entrepreneurs carry, in a disruptive way, that if you're not doing something that people aren't laughing at you and doubting you, I can't tell you how many people, when I graduated law school and I went into the internet, right? I'm going to be in moot court, an oil and gas litigator. All my friends, including all my relatives, you and I come from kind of the same background, Aaron, they're like, he's not going to be a real lawyer. Oh my God, what is he doing? It was crazy. But 9 months later, when I was a millionaire, everybody was applauding me. My friends that were making fun of me were asking me for jobs or loans, even worse. I'd rather give them a job than a loan. And I think it's really important to understand that you have to vote for what you want. You have to believe in yourself and know that you're going to make a ton of mistakes. I've proven it, but that didn't stop me. I had great success, made huge mistakes, and then came right back with the same philosophy to, again, create more abundance for more people and create change.
I'm pretty sure I have that same Jewish uncle, by the way.
He sounds the same way.
Yeah, he's probably also watching. What is he doing?
Oh, no, I'm sorry to your uncle.
Well, this is coming on right, right after Yom Kippur. We can all ask for a donation after this.
That's right. I might need it. Cindy, Dave pointed out something about not caring about what other people think, but in learning about your story and this job that you sought at Merck, it seems like there were some elements at that time that you might have been chasing validation from others. I'm wondering if you agree with that.
Oh, I think there was a huge shift in my career. And a lot of the reason I show up in pink all of the time is it was a shift for me from underestimated to unapologetic. And the unapologetic, I take in all of the feedback, right? The negative and the positive. You got to listen to your critics as much as you listen to your fans, because that's the only way you're going to figure out how to navigate the course. But I think that it became very important to me that I really had two decisions to make in that underestimation, right? I could either lean away from it. It would cause self-doubt and probably, frustration. Or I could go right for it, for all the assumptions and break through it. And as my personality goes, I went right for it. Dave said something that I think I have a very favorite quote, a Gandhi quote, and probably so many in your audience. I think all good entrepreneurs and started, Dave's already smiling because he knows what I'm going to say. And it is, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. And I think that has described sort of my entire journey of, you know, first you're overlooked, you don't fit in the room, then you're doing something a little bit different, or you're sort of the misfit, they're laughing at you, then they're struggling with you because you're actually making inroads and it's fundamentally challenging something they believe in. And then ultimately, if you stick to your guns and you truly have the courage and conviction, you win. And what you do, hopefully, is you also win them over to see a different way.
You know, not your bio reads, you know, like something like an amazing success story. But I want to be clear that behind the scenes, how difficult these things are. So, you know, for the people who maybe pursue that determined path of here's what I'm going to pursue, and people think I'm crazy. Some of them, maybe they aren't crazy, but the ideas don't work out. And, yeah, you know, maybe first start with what's something you pursued that didn't quite work out? And when did you know to throw in the towel?
Oh my God. What day? Yesterday? Or is this like in my career? I mean, really, there's so many things, you know, that I have pursued that don't pan out. I'm learning every day. I think, you know, one of the marks of great entrepreneurs, humans, is that they actually choose to be learning daily. They have an insatiable curiosity that keeps an open mind. And so, you know, my gosh, I can give you so many different examples along my career. I have failed. I mean, it's the Jordan commercial, right? I have failed more times than I have ever, I've failed however many times and therefore I succeed. God, I'm killing myself. I'm not even giving a good reference to my childhood. You know the commercial. And I think that failure is a daily part of the equation, that I'm trying new things, but the difference is I'm trying it. I'm not waiting and calculating this one perfect decision. And I think that that's sort of our human nature, is that we want it to be perfect. And what we should do is not make one perfect decision, but make 10 decisions. And you know what? Two of those may be great, and you're way ahead of the game.
So Dave, how do you think people, entrepreneurs, balance the crazy gene, right? I mean, the stats are against us. Many of the businesses don't work out. And some of those people, you know, I don't think they're actually crazy, but I think some of the ideas just aren't marketable. So they're convinced themselves until they realize maybe it's not going to work out. I've unfortunately had that experience a few times over. But when do people say it's time to try something different, get a more traditional job, satisfy my crazy uncle? Like when do people move in that direction?
You know, I mentor a lot of people, and this is a critical business issue for them. The perspective of stopping and quitting. And it's the same perspective I utilize with pain, right? A lot of people see pain itself as a stop sign. Okay, this is over. And where I really see things differentiating is that pain is an indicator. It's a turn signal. It's telling you, hey, you need to move in a better direction to be in a better situation to make something better. And if you take that perspective, you can utilize this as the roadmap where you make so many mistakes, but yet you never really stop evolving. A company may have a different name. The ideas may have a different topic or a content to it. So here's the simplest way to look at it, and it really works. One, always be happy with where you're at. Right? Always know that you're at the right place at the perfect time. And what we're trying to do is to enjoy the consistent, persistent pursuit of our potential, which is angling towards something better. And you need to know your what. You're propelled by your why, but you need to know your what to angle towards that. And here's the nuance that I learned through being an old man now and being able to look back and connect the dots backwards through the dummy tax I paid. And it's that not only am I angling towards something better, but I actually have faith that I'll end up somewhere better than that I even dream of or the what that I have. So I'm happy where I'm at. I'm angling towards something better, but I certainly have faith that I'm going to end up somewhere better than that. And it could be an entirely different industry career, but yet all the skills, knowledge, and desire are just growing and expanding that lead me to a different direction.
Yeah, that's impressive. I hope people can really take that to heart, because if you can be focused on that and driven by that, I think you can end up happy and successful by any measure. Cindy, you know, I want to get back to the empowerment of women. You know, you're next to two white guys here. What can we be doing?
Guys worse.
Even worse. What could we be doing? And even if we think we're doing our best, what are many people likely getting wrong about, or could be doing better if we're trying to be more positive about empowering more female entrepreneurs and leaders?
Well, I think you have to first, you know, take a look around the table and make sure that everybody who's sitting there doesn't look exactly like you. And I think that comes in many forms. It's walks of life. It's different upbringings, childhoods, whatever. You know, there's a variety of things. There's certainly, gender diversity, ethnic diversity. I think that's a piece of it because, boy, how boring would those decisions be if we were really just sitting around and all of us had the same frame of reference? We will not be as exceptional an organization. And I'm going to say one thing that I think will surprise you. The thing that is missing in many ways, I think, is candor. And I think in an effort right now to be supportive, good guys, like the two guys I'm sitting on here with, who are wanting to be supportive, who are wanting to sponsor and mentor women, I think that we are in a societal state right now where everybody's on high alert for what they say. And actually what I find many times when I have young women come, and I work with a lot of colleges, to the Pinkubator, is they've been cheered on. And I like that they're being cheered on, but I have to sit down and say, okay, once all of your sorority sisters buy this piece of jewelry that you've just made, then what? And I think it's an important conversation. Maybe I'm in a seat that can have that conversation sort of woman to woman with her today. And I get to say, you're great. You have everything it takes to do this, but go find a better idea. And I think that's the blend is one, you've got to constantly be checking yourself, and then you've got to push yourself beyond tiptoeing because of everything you're being told, you know, culturally right now, and be really direct and honest with everyone you have an interaction with, because that's the only way you'll truly help them be successful.
I wonder if you encourage your companies where there's majority of leadership of women to also invite men around the table.
I invest in men. So I will say that. I invest in men doing great things for women. I just have a particular love in the space of women's health and wellness. I have wonderful men I've invested in who are inventing things. Alzheimer's, for example, we have a technology. 2/3 of all Alzheimer's patients are women. And so it disproportionately affects that population. So that's an example of something that might be incubator. Absolutely, I encourage that. I have these values in my organizations over time, one of which is to choose to be quirky. I don't know that you can just wake up and say, I'm going to be quirky. But what I really mean by that is from learning the hard way inside of kind of classic corporate, and you brought that up, Aaron, like when I went to work for the premier, right? There was some validation that I got hired by the elite. I recognized that part of their business equation was to homogenize. And it was like beating everybody into one way. We had one way of getting everything done. And I thought the best organizations are not the ones that make there be a sea of sameness. The best are the ones that find those who stand out and then give them permission to be themselves, to be quirky.
You've created it seems like really great company cultures that in some ways are, I've heard you describe, like a cult. And what do you do to empower? You know, I'm really fascinated by your first trait of ownership.
Yes.
I found that when trying to recruit people who want to be owners, they tend to go into entrepreneurship and not want to be employees. So I'm curious how you identify owners and how you get them so massively bought into the mission and empowered around the organization.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, so it is my first choice. And I think every day is a choice. We're going to wake up and consciously decide exactly how we're going to go through this world and this life. Dave is such a great speaker on that, of these conscious choices that you make. But choosing to be an owner is more than just skin in the game. It is the way that we unite and we lock arms against sort of the rest of the world in our mission and what we're trying to accomplish. And I think that part of that is that I hire for it explicitly. I fire against it. I incentivize it. I celebrate it. It's not a BS values on a wall. It's really who I'm looking for. And I would say hiring is the most important point. And ownership, I think you can tease out from just allowing somebody to storytell the things that are most important to them. What was their first job ever? right? And I don't mean like, what was my first job out of college when I had a resume? I mean, like, I used to put, you know, flyers in my neighbor's mailbox for odd jobs. Like, that kind of mindset starts early. And I think you can really hear it. I'll tell you.
What was your first job, Cindy?
Oh, my first job. Nobody let
me. The way you say it, which is, which I think is a better way to put it. So I'm sorry to interrupt, but interviewing with what was the first way you made money, which I think is an important distinction.
It is an important distinction. Thank you. The first way I made made money was off of my brothers. And I used to make them pay me to bring them things from the refrigerator. They're so
awesome.
They would actually pay their little sister to do, like, I basically did their grunt work in order to steal some of their allowance for my own. That's how it worked. Yeah.
Dave, what was the first way you made money, Dave?
Oh, God, I'm going to be in trouble for this. But I grew up in Akron, Ohio, and I grew up with a single mom and six kids. So we had a two-bedroom apartment in Fairlawn, which was not a great neighborhood. I was actually the minority in my neighborhood. So at a very young age, I was really fast and inconspicuous. I didn't know what I was carrying, but let us just know that I was a runner and I was given a paper bag to run from my house up to Lawson's, which was like a mile away, which was like a 7-Eleven. And I'd take it from one sketchy looking dude and I'd run as fast as I can. They told me not to talk to anyone, to hide the bag in the hoodie of my jacket.
Oh my God.
I'd run with it and then I'd give it to the guy and he'd give me $5. And then my mom, I was like 6 or 7, would ask me how I had all this money. And I'd say bottle caps. I wouldn't even say recycling cans. I told her that I sold bottle caps.
That's hilarious.
I think my mom had too many kids to even care, but I was basically a drug runner, I think.
That's awesome. You both share, you know, dealing drugs in your careers. Very different stories. So many questions. Part of today's focus is around better wellness. The theme of the week is, or the event overall, is creating a better future for all. Today's focus is around better wellness. So I want to spend a moment on how the tech community can play a role in making people more well. So Cindy, you know, you shared a few ideas you're investing in. Whether people are specifically in the industry of wellness or could be thinking about creating a culture of wellness or building technology for wellness, what are some ways that we can leverage technology for wellness?
Well, look, I'm going to go to just a particular passion area of mine, which is telemedicine. And anybody who's doing anything in the vein that supports that, or even if you run an organization and encouraging your employees in this way. And here's why I say that. For years, I have been in what I consider to be very stigmatized conditions. Those things that people don't like to talk about out loud or even have a little bit of embarrassment to bring up with their physicians. And I think that this ability to either chat like this or to do it, you know, from the comfort of my couch on my phone eliminates so much of the shame and stigma, particularly as it relates to mental health and wellness, is that's just been catapulted through, if there's a silver lining, right, of quarantine and this pandemic, our inability to physically go in has really stoked this entire industry. And I think it will leave us a healthier entire generation, if you will, because we've had different access to care. It's more affordable, it's more convenient. And I think it takes away some shame.
Yeah, absolutely. Dave, what same question to you. What do you think the tech community can do to drive a better wellness?
What I'm focusing on and working on is mindset, technology of mindset, of neural pathway training, companies like Muse and, you know, even Headspace. I think that we have neglected the greater and bigger technology of the universe that now can be, number one, identified, given awareness to, and also value. And we're making the investment into the technologies to understand that continuum of the conscious, subconscious, and unconscious mind. Because if we can control the mindset, we then have the ability to be catalyst to the heart set, which is the way we feel. And, you know, curing the disease is one thing, but we could actually cure the cause with having the appropriate mindset. I believe that healing comes from within in our own mindset, and that if we can actually train people to see the I get to do, not I got to do, the try me, not why me, the ability to do these things. So there is tons of killer technology out there that is helping people with their mindset. And that's really where I'm focused right now, in changing the way people look at things so the things they look at change.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, Cindy, you talk about, you know, you've dealt with these issues that can be make people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
How have you always been someone who has leaned into having, you know, this what I would say like the shock value conversation? Has that always been part of you, or did you learn to get comfortable with that?
No, I had to get comfortable. Yeah, I really did. And I it wasn't inherently how I was. I think I was more modest about it. And yet the injustice that we weren't discussing this after I spent time with, you know, thousands of women, and I've been talking to them, and they feel alone in that because we actually, nobody will put voice to it. That's really what ignited me to sort of have the bravery to go forward. I mean, again, it ultimately comes down to courage to say it out loud when we're tackling something like this.
Yeah, I noticed that you say that the media like to call the female Viagra, but you didn't say that. No. Why is that?
It's not how it works. And I think it creates a construct like everything is on demand. And every woman in your audience right now knows we're not on demand when it comes to desire is unlocked in the brain. And I think it's a disservice that yet again, like it has to be a male construct. Contextually, it was right. This was a watershed moment in women's health. It broke the doors open for what I consider the next phase of the sexual revolution, which is pleasure. But we work differently. And therefore, yeah, it's not female Viagra at all. It's a brain.
It seems like as a wise marketer, you didn't distance yourself too far from it either, because it was
a runaway train. I got to tell you, that was too delicious of clickbait for media to put in the headline. And so we spend a lot of time saying why it's not today, just to set patient expectations.
Yeah, I mean, I also have to think that in the industry you're in, and talking about female empowerment, I've got to think you've heard some crazy things, both in an investor meeting or pitching physicians. I mean, any stories you can share? Go ahead.
I got invited to the show. It was the big, you know, I'm a small privately held company. I'm trying to raise money to get this quote female Viagra across the finish line. And I was invited to the biggest healthcare conference of the year. And this was my 8 minutes to, you know, attract investors, to impress. And I got up there to give my presentation. I'm dressed in pink. I don't quite look like all other pharmaceutical CEOs. And I can remember looking at my countdown clock, and I started to talk, and the whole room started to giggle. It was like a wave that went over the whole crowd. And all I could do is glance at my clock, glance at my chairman, glance at my clock, glance at my chairman, who's staring at me like, what are you going to do? And I advanced my slides as fast as I could to brain scan images. This is really why I became so passionate about this. We know from brain scan studies, there's a fundamental biologic difference. And I got the brain scans up on the screen, and I pointed to them, and I just went silent. And I was silent for so long, the whole room went silent. And I said, are you looking at what I'm looking at? Because I'm just here to talk about the biology of sex and women. And everyone quieted down. But it was really an important lesson for me in how I was going to have to go into this conversation, because I was first going to be met with the giggles and the laughs.
Really what you honed in on was how to capture people's attention and be taken seriously quickly, yeah, right?
Quickly.
And so what do you tell people? I mean, I think people mess up a pitch all day long. I'm not accusing you of having messed up that pitch in the JP Morgan Health Summit.
Oh, I messed up a lot of pitches.
It happens, right? Yeah, what do you recommend to people to capture attention? I think people have, we say 3 minutes. I think you have 10 seconds to capture somebody's mind share. What do you tell people to start with?
Be authentic. You screw it up. Say right at that moment. You literally say in the moment, like, holy crap, you're making me nervous. I just screwed that up. I'm starting over. If you acknowledge it, I'm totally bought into you. I already have like built a trust with you that you're going to own it and say it truthfully. I think the worst part is that we try to recover or cover it up and move forward. So much better to just be authentically who you are in the room every single time.
I love that. Dave, same question to you. How do you, you also hear tons of pitches. What do you think the right structure is? What do people get right? What should entrepreneurs watching this think, okay, if I want to capture attention, here's what I need to do.
Real quickly, like I say on my new show, The 2 Minute Drill, number one, credibility. People ignore credibility. That's what Cindy's talking about. Two is emotional attachment. And then three, people forget to quantify, not subjective value, but to quantify the reasons that they should invest or do this. Two, the impact. And then three, the capabilities they have. credibility, emotional attachment, and then quantify reasons, impacts, and capabilities. That's the perfect pitch.
There's three questions you should answer for an investor. I think of this all the time when people sit across from me. It is, what are you uniquely trying to do? Right? Tell me what it is unique, and don't gloss over competition. That's not helpful. Why are you the person to do it? And I would argue that's the very most important point. I bet on people, not on the ideas. And ultimately, what's in it for me if I go on the ride with you? And it's, to David's point on quantifying something, I think that's often lost. If you can ladder up everything you say to those three kind of takeaways for me, I will understand what your ask is.
Love that. I love that. So we're almost out of time. Actually, I'd add one other tip there, which I'm shocked how few entrepreneurs do this, which is practice, record yourself, watch it back, and see how you did. And I'm shocked at how few entrepreneurs actually do that. And like, oh, I didn't realize I was half naked or scratching my face or whatever else the whole time, or stumbled 1,000 times. It's the easiest thing to do, but practice, record yourself, watch it back. So as I mentioned, the theme of this week is to build a better future for all. So the last question is, how can we build a better future for all? We're at a moment in time where I think many of us feel like it's particularly important to be thinking about this issue. I'll start with you, Dave. I'll end with you, Cindy, on what could we do as a tech community, as a society overall, to build a better future?
Two things. Just be aware of what our vested interests are. I know no one on earth that does not have a woman in their life that was a significant player in their life. So let's look at what we have a vested interest in. And then two, open-mindedness. I think that so many people are narrowing, closing, and separating their minds. I always say the best way to stimulate interest, I don't care what industry or what you're trying to do, is just let's find people with open minds and share our ideas to increase, expand, and accelerate what we're trying to do. So know what you have a vested interest in and open up your mind.
Cindy, same question. How do we build a better future for all?
Make decisions based on a collective outcome, not just your own. If you win, make your win other people's win as well.
Hope you enjoyed this episode of The Playbook, but more importantly, I want you to join my text community. I'm doing a lot of fun things there, one-on-one conversations, trainings, giveaways, and it's the first place I release all of the information that I'm giving. So join me at my text platform, 949-298-2905. That's 949-298-2905. Join my exclusive community.